Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's March something. Let me look at my watch. March 1st? Yeah, because yesterday is the 29th. I had to reset my watch. Okay, so it is March 1st. And as I look at the schedule right here, I notice that exam 2 is scheduled for Thursday, March 15th. So what the heck is that? 2 weeks away. Okay, 2 weeks away. So we're going to finish up respiration this time and then go on to some nervous system. We're going to have 3 nice long lectures on nervous system. All right, so here is one of the first slides for cellular respiration. All right, so you should be studying this one and come and look at this diagram every time you read a section in your textbook to relate what you're learning in the textbook to this particular slide. Okay, so here we have blood glucose, and blood glucose can come from a number of different places, 2 different places, depending on what state you're in. If you're in a fed state, where is glucose going to come from? It's going to come from your digestive tract, right? And when you're in a fasted state, blood glucose is going to have a tendency to drop, but the liver can break what down? Glycogen, and then it can secrete glucose into the blood to maintain blood glucose levels. All right, and then glucose can be taken up by some cells if a proper signal is there. Does anybody know what that signal for cellular glucose uptake is? There has to be a signal secreted by the pancreas, and that is insulin. Insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter cells. And if there is no insulin signal, glucose cannot enter most cells. So what's going to happen to the cell? Well, it's eventually going to die, right? Because it can't get glucose. So that's how important that process is. All right, if glucose enters the cell into the cytosol right here, there's a process that can break glucose down into 2 molecules. Just snip it in half, right? So glucose has 6 carbons. When it gets snipped in half, it produces 2 3 carbon molecules that we call pyruvate. The process that produces that is glycolysis, right? And pyruvate has 2 different fates. What are the 2 different fates for pyruvate or pyruvic acid, right? There's synonymous, there's synonyms. What are the 2 possible fates for pyruvic acid? We see it on here. Yeah, it can be converted into lactic acid via an anaerobic pathway, or pyruvic acid can enter a mitochondria and be completely broken down into carbon dioxide and water. Okay, so those are the 2 possible fates, 2 possible different locations within the cell, and 2 different pathways. One is anaerobic and the other is aerobic. So what's a molecule that's necessary for aerobic respiration? Oxygen, yeah, absolutely, because oxygen is going to accept electrons from the electron transport chain, keeping ETC working, right? So that's this last part. What kind of molecules bring electrons to the electron transport chain? Okay. Anybody have an idea? Okay. Is it going to be a cofactor or a coenzyme? Coenzyme, right? Because a cofactor is just a small metal ion, but a coenzyme is a large organic molecule that carries something from one set of chemical reactions to another set of chemical reactions. And what carries electrons into electron transport chain right here is NADH and FADH2. Those are the coenzymes that carry high energy electrons into the electron transport chain. And that kind of takes us to where we are currently in lecture, right? Because we talked about anaerobic respiration. And I think we stopped around here sometime last time. All right, so we have NADH. And is NADH in a reduced form or oxidized form? Okay. When something is reduced, it means it has accepted electrons from someplace, from another molecule. And when it has accepted electrons, it means it's reduced. All right, so NADH is a reduced form. It has extra electrons. NAD plus is an oxidized form. So NADH will then donate electrons to FMN, and thereby reducing FMN. So that's going to be FMNH2. And then these electrons will be subsequently donated to other kinds of compounds embedded in the mitochondrial membrane, the inner mitochondrial membrane that we call the Christie membrane. Oh yeah, here it is right here, the Christie membrane of the mitochondria. And as these electrons flow from high energy to low energy, and finally being accepted by oxygen right here to produce water, right, that energy can be used to synthesize ATP. And because this is driven by oxygen, we call this oxidative phosphorylation. So you probably see some things even maybe on TV ads, right? You can buy coenzyme Q10, right? And so these are just what we call cytochromes within mitochondria that help a cell produce energy. So they're being sold on the basis that you'll feel more energetic and et cetera, but I'm not so sure that really matters if you have a decent diet. Okay, now all of these compounds like CoQ10, cytochrome B, and all these other cytochromes are lipid-soluble compounds. So that's why we find them in the cell membrane, because they can dissolve within the membrane of mitochondria, the Christi membrane in particular. All right, the other thing that you should notice from this diagram is that there's a difference between NADH and FADH2, where they donate electrons. The electrons in FADH2 are a little bit lower energy, so they're donated in a little bit lower region within ETC. So electrons from NADH can produce 3 ATPs. Electrons from FADH2 can only produce 2 ATPs. So when we calculate the overall yield of ATP production, that's going to matter in our calculations. Okay. All right, so NADH and FADH2 carry electrons from the Krebs cycle to the ETC, but remember, there is another pathway that produces NADH. What was that? There's actually two other pathways. And I tell you what, I'm going to have to go back really fast. Let's take a look at that. Sorry about flipping. One couple more slides right here. All right, so remember, glycolysis produces two NADHs. All right, and so not just the Krebs cycle, and then that preparatory reaction before the Krebs cycle also produces NADHs as well. All right, and the Krebs cycle, every turn of the Krebs cycle produces 3. For a pyruvic acid, 1 NADH from the preparatory reaction, and then 2 from glycolysis are produced. So those are all high energy electrons that aren't wasted. All right, let's go back to this slide right here. All right, so how does ATP get produced when electrons flow through the electron transport chain? Let's describe what this figure right here, and it's called the chemiosmotic theory, all right? And so here we have a mitochondrial membrane. Here is the outer membrane right here. Can you tell this is a membrane? How could you tell this is a membrane? It's a nice simple phospholipid bilayer. And then inside the mitochondria, look what we have. Another membrane, another phospholipid bilayer, okay? But now I see a bunch of compounds embedded in the membrane. These are all lipophilic proteins and other kinds of lipophilic compounds, like ubiquinone is the same thing as CoQ10. And NADH, if it's inside the mitochondrial inner membrane, which we call the matrix, so this compartment is the matrix, that's the most inner part of the mitochondria. And then here is a space between the outer and inner membrane, we call that the intermembrane space. All right, so we got a nice separation of spaces right here. NADH is going to be in the matrix and it's carrying high energy electrons. It can donate it to this protein, and I guess we call that FMN. And it's a special protein so that when it receives high energy electrons and when it donates it to CoQ10, it's going to take protons that are in the matrix and pump them into this intermembrane space. So it's going to take protons from low concentration and put them to high concentration. Now, is that just diffusion when something goes from low concentration to high? No, that's active transport, right? And the energy is coming from the flow of these electrons from NADH through the electron transport chain. All right, so if we stop the flow of electrons somehow or another, then this protein cannot pump protons up into the inner membrane space. Okay, so then this electron flows into CoQ10. Right, and the electrons from FADH2 actually enter this system through this CoQ10 or ubiquinone and start to flow down. So you can see that electrons from FADH2 only support the action of the second and third pump right here, but not all three. therefore it can't produce quite as many ATP. Right, and electrons will flow through the electron transport chain in the Christi membrane right here through all these different cytochromes only if oxygen is available to accept those electrons. All right, so it's just going to flow from one compound to another compound and then finally into oxygen that's in the matrix of the mitochondria. And when these electrons combine with oxygen with some protons as well, then water is going to be produced. So the very last compound that is produced by the electron transport chain is water. Okay. All right. And oxygen is being used up. Okay. And don't forget, mitochondria are also responsible for producing CO2. What steps or what reactions within the mitochondria produce carbon dioxide, which is the reason why we exhale? Does anybody remember? Krebs cycle produces two carbon dioxides. All right. But for every pyruvic acid, you're going to produce three. So where's the third one coming from? And actually, if we think in a chronological order, it's really the first one. Okay? The first one is being produced by the preparatory reaction when pyruvic acid is converted into acetyl coenzyme A or acetyl CoA. Right? That's a decarboxylation reaction. Okay, so these electrons are taken care of. It's producing water. And at every time it goes through, an electron passes through a pump right here, it pumps hydrogen from the matrix into the intermembrane space. So we have a high concentration of protons in this inner mitochondrial or the intermembrane space right here. And it's low inside the matrix. So what do these protons want to do? They want to go down their concentration gradient, right? They want to re-enter the matrix by diffusion, for instance, from high concentration to low. All right, so you know energy can be converted from one form to another, and I see a very interesting form of energy right here. Okay, and think of secondary active transport. How can a molecule go from low concentration to high concentration in terms of energy balance? If it's coupled to what a gradient of another molecule, like maybe a sodium gradient. So if sodium goes down its concentration gradient, it can cause another molecule to go up its concentration gradient via secondary active transport. You had to draw that out a couple times. All right, so here we have protons going down their concentration gradient. Protons can't get through this membrane because it's an ion, right? Can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. But here is a fourth protein that's embedded in the Christi matrix, and it is a pathway for letting protons diffuse down the concentration gradient from high concentration to low. But remember, there's energy when that happens, so that energy can be converted into another form. And that other form of energy is a chemical energy in the form of ATP. So as protons flow down this concentration gradient, right, from high to low, it can actually cause the synthesis of ATP as a result of this enzyme protein in the membrane. And this protein we call ATP synthase, or sometimes it's called ATP synthetase. Either one is fine. All right, so it's using the energy of protons flowing back into the matrix, going from high to low, to make ATP. And this is what we call oxidative phosphorylation, because what molecule is necessary to make sure that this happens? Oxygen is necessary. So this is oxidative phosphorylation. So this is a fancy kind of protein, and we can actually see these proteins with really high-resolution electron microscopy. So if we look at the inner membrane of a mitochondria, we can actually see these things embedded in the membrane of mitochondria, the Christi membrane. Okay, so what else should you take away from this? All right, make sure you know the name of this theory, and when we say theory, what does that mean? It's been clearly shown, right, by many different laboratories that in reality inside mitochondria, this is what's happening. So it's something that you can count on, right? It's not just a hypothesis. All right, so when you look at this, you should realize that the gradient of protons from the inner membrane to the matrix is sufficiently high, right, that there's a lot of energy in that gradient that can be used to make ATP as a result of this ATP synthetase. Right, but in order for ATP synthetase to make ATP, there has to be a high concentration of protons in this inner membrane space to flow down this gradient. All right, so I think I've talked about everything on this slide already, so I probably don't want to talk about it again. But here's just some verbiage that goes along with the slide. All right, so mitochondria are responsible for making ATP, right, if oxygen is present. Let's just talk about a circumstance that we don't deal with clinically very well just yet. All right, remember that ATP is necessary to run all of the energy-requiring processes inside your cell, and mitochondria are happy to provide ATP for us as long as, okay, there is oxygen for them. But mitochondria, even more importantly, like to keep this intermembrane space high in protons, right? Which means what in terms of pH? High pH or low pH? Low pH. High concentration of hydrogen ions means a very low pH. So that's what mitochondria really want to do for us. And every once in a while, if we starve a mitochondria of oxygen right here, how can a mitochondria maintain a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space? Okay, because these protons want to go back down, right? And if there is no oxygen present, what happens to these pumps? The pumps stop working. The proton pumps stop working. So then the mitochondria thinks, oh, the pH over here is going too high. I want it to be very acidic. So guess what happens? The mitochondria then can reverse the action of this protein right here. It can take ATP from the matrix, convert it into ADP, and it can then pump protons from the matrix into this intermembrane space. Now what happens to our cells when that happens? What happens when instead of mitochondria making ATP, they actually use the ATP that our cells would like to have? Well, yeah, that hastens the death of the cells that they're living in, unfortunately. Under what? Under anaerobic conditions. Under conditions, for instance, maybe you have a stroke and a blood vessel breaks in your brain or it gets occluded with a plaque or something like that, then the mitochondria actually become our foes instead of our friends because they use up the ATP that the rest of the processes inside our cells need. Okay, we don't know how to deal with that problem very well yet, other than by just reestablishing blood flow to organs to make sure that all of our organs have sufficient oxygen to keep those mitochondria happy. All right, so this ATP synthetase can actually go in either direction, and if ATP is at a high concentration, or for instance, if there's NADH and oxygen present, then this ATP synthetase is happy to make ATP. But as soon as oxygen is depressed and ETC can't work, then mitochondria are going to use the ATP synthase to pump proteins into this membrane space at the expense of ATP, right? So instead of a synthetase, it becomes a pump that's pumping, right? And what kind of pump would that be? Primary active transport or secondary active transport? If it's going to work in the reverse direction. Yeah, it's primary because, it's using ATP. Okay. All right, so we all want to keep our mitochondria really nice and happy. All right, so ATP, as we've seen, can be made in two general ways. One I call substrate-level phosphorylation. Your book likes to call it direct. That's fine. You can call it direct, but you should know it's just substrate-level phosphorylation. And that's just due to enzymatic activity. All right, ATP is generated when bonds break. Right, both of the ATPs in glycolysis are made that way, by substrate-level phosphorylation, but there is another metabolic pathway that can make ATP directly or through substrate-level phosphorylation, and that is the Krebs cycle. So even though the Krebs cycle is dependent on oxygen to operate, it still can make ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation. We'll consider that in a little bit of detail later on in the class. And where does Krebs cycle take place? Inside the mitochondria, okay? So direct level or substrate level phosphorylation can happen during anaerobic respiration via glycolysis as well as anaerobic respiration in that one step in the Krebs cycle. And remember, for every glucose, how many times does the Krebs cycle operate? How many times does it turn? Okay, it goes around twice because glucose has six carbons, and what enters the Krebs cycle is basically a modified pyruvate. You get two pyruvic acids from every glucose. So remember, the Krebs cycle goes around twice. That's why we say two ATPs right here. All right, the second step is oxidative phosphorylation. All right, and that's when Krebs cycle and the preparatory reaction generate NADH and FADH2, and those compounds are going to carry high energy electrons to electron transport chain. And there are many more ATPs produced by the electron transport chain via what kind of phosphorylation? Oxidative phosphorylation. Remember, oxygen is necessary for that last step to produce water. All right, and so we're going to do a comparison of these couple different pathways in just a little bit. Okay, I don't want to go over that one. Let's look at this step right here. This is probably what I want you to be aware of. For every NADH that donates a pair of electrons to electron transport chain, I just want you to memorize 3 ATP are produced under ideal conditions, the best conditions possible, and that's the only one I want to consider in this class. And FADH2 can only produce 2 ATPs under ideal conditions. Right, which means then that whenever your cells are not operating under ideal conditions, right, it produces a little bit less, and your book makes a pretty big deal of that. They like to say 2.5 and 1.5, right, for every NADH and FADH2, but that's a complication I don't think we need to deal with in this class. So for you, I just want you to memorize for every NADH inside the mitochondria, it's going to make 3 ATP, and FADH2 is going to produce 2 ATP. All right, so let's take a look at this. All right, so we get a lot of ATP from electron transport chain, 2 from glycolysis, 2 ATPs from substrate level phosphorylation in the Krebs cycle, because remember the Krebs cycle goes around twice. And, okay, so it's about 30 ATPs. That's really kind of the ballpark figure I want you to know for aerobic respiration. Aerobic respiration starting with what molecule? What is the nutrient molecule? Glucose, yeah, so if we put glucose into aerobic respiration, what we get out is 30-something ATPs under aerobic conditions. But under anaerobic conditions, how many ATP are produced? Okay, because under anaerobic conditions, glucose will only go through glycolysis and then into lactic acid, so you can only consider what's happening during glycolysis because lactate dehydrogenase doesn't use up any or make any ATPs, right? It's only glycolysis, and it's just 2 ATPs under anaerobic conditions. So I want you just to appreciate the difference between aerobic respiration and anaerobic respiration. Which is better for you to make ATPs with? Aerobic respiration, right? Because it completely oxidizes glucose into carbon dioxide and water. All right, so this table is pretty good, but I would like for you to change a couple things. Let's just go over these things. Phases of respiration, glucose to pyruvate, that happens in the cytoplasm. Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that statement right there? Glucose to pyruvate in the cytoplasm? Absolutely you should. Okay, I'm trying to trick you. I want you to think of that diagram at the very beginning of the chapter, because what do we call that step right there? That's glycolysis, right? All right, so glycolysis produces 2 ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. But what else does glycolysis produce? The 2 NADHs. Okay, now where are these located? Where are these NADHs located? In the cytoplasm. But if they're going to donate electrons to electron transport chain, where do they have to get to? If they got to now enter the mitochondria, and when NADH enters mitochondria, right, they have to give up some energy when they do that, and they usually enter, those electrons usually enter as FADH2, not NADH. So some electrons get transferred through the membrane, but NADH doesn't, and what's inside the mitochondria matrix is FAD, which accepts those electrons, and then you have FADH2. Now, how many ATP can be made from an NADH inside the mitochondria? 3. How many ATPs can be made from an FADH2 inside the mitochondria? 2. So the cost of importing these electrons from cytosolic NADH into the mitochondria is what? 1 ATP for every NADH. Okay. So what do we have right here? By ATP made by oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, here is what? Substrate level phosphorylation or directly, and here's just a little intermediate step to help us understand oxidative phosphorylation. So for every FADH2 inside the mitochondria matrix, how many ATP are we going to produce? Okay, I want to say 2 instead of 1.5. So this table right here says under usual conditions, we think maybe this is a good average. We're not sure, and I don't want to talk about all the different conditions. I just want to think about the ideal condition, the optimal maximum. So that would be, what, 2 ATP for every FADH. And in glycolysis, how many NADHs are made? Okay, in glycolysis, two are made. Okay, but they're outside the mitochondria. And don't forget, NADH is converted into FADH2 as it enters. So you got these two NADHs get converted into two FADs. All right, and then you can make two ATPs. So that is what, really four right here. Okay, so four from the NADH that's made by glycolysis. All right, then what's the next reaction? Okay, if, for instance, if this is anaerobic conditions, then, you know, that's pretty much it. But if it's under aerobic conditions, what can happen to this pyruvate right here? It can enter the mitochondria, and it's converted into acetyl-CoA. That's the preparatory reaction. That's a decarboxylation reaction. There's no direct level phosphorylation in that particular step, but what is produced? Okay, and NADH is produced, right, for every pyruvate. But how many pyruvate do you have for every glucose? There are two, right? So that produces two NADHs. Now, where are these NADHs? Don't forget, this is aerobic conditions. Where are these NADHs? In the cytosol or inside the mitochondria? They're inside the mitochondria, right? So then we don't have to degrade their energy level. So it's going to be 3 ATPs, because that's what I want you to know, 3 ATPs for every NADH. And how many are there? 2. So we would say 6 in this location. Okay? These are under ideal conditions. All right, let's look at our next line. Here is glycolysis. Here's the preparatory reaction. Then here's the Krebs cycle. Okay, Krebs cycle, don't forget, for every glucose goes around twice. If it goes around one time, it produces one ATP by what kind of phosphorylation step? By what kind of? Oxidative phosphorylation requires electron transport chain. And I don't see electron transport chain right here. It's that Krebs cycle, which is substrate level phosphorylation for every pyruvate. All right, but remember, it goes around twice for every glucose, and that's what we're considering right here. So there are two substrate level phosphorylation steps in the Krebs cycle because it has to go around twice. Two ATPs are produced. So for aerobic respiration, which is kind of what we're talking about right here, by substrate level phosphorylation, how many ATPs are produced? Four, right? Two from glycolysis and two from the Krebs cycle, just by direct or substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, now Krebs cycle. How many NADHs are made for one loop, one turn? There's three. How many FADHs are produced? There's one, right? So it's three and one. And remember, it goes around twice. So change these numbers, 3 ATP for NADH. And since they're in the mitochondria already, they don't get converted into FADH. So 3 times 3 is 9. Okay, but how many times does the Krebs cycle go around? Twice, so 9 times 2 is 18. So you want to put down 18 ATP right here instead of 15. All right, so that changes this 2.5. Got 3 NADHs times 3 ATP for NADH, but every time the Krebs cycle goes around twice for every glucose, so that's 18. Okay, and then you have that one FADH from one turn of the Krebs cycle. How many ATP are produced for every FADH2? You got two, right? So cross that off, put two, because we're going to only consider ideal conditions. All right, so that goes around twice, so that's going to be four. And if you add all of that up, the corrected numbers, that's going to give you, what, 30 or 32, something like that. All right, and then if we add that with these four ATP, then you get 34 ATP by what kind of respiration? Aerobic respiration. And how many ATPs are made by anaerobic respiration? Only two. Right, so that's really the take-home message that you have to see. Aerobic respiration produces a measly... Anaerobic, hopefully I said anaerobic respiration, but I didn't. Caught myself. Anaerobic respiration produces a measly 2 ATPs, and aerobic respiration right here produces what? 30-something depending on the conditions, right? So you could say, you wouldn't hurt my feelings if you were to say 34, 36, maybe 38, 32, somewhere in there, but up in the 30s, all depending on conditions inside the cell. And what organelle has to be happy in order for aerobic respiration to take place? Mitochondria. And what does it need? What does a mitochondria need to do its job? It needs oxygen. Okay. All right, so that's pretty important. Now, I want to stop and kind of ask for questions regarding this scheme right here. All right? Who's got some questions regarding the chemiosmotic theory of ATP production, which is oxidative phosphorylation? Okay, so don't forget what is running this thing are coenzymes, NADH and FADH2, which are reduced forms of these cofactors, so they can donate electrons to these components in the Christi membrane of a mitochondria. And as these electrons flow through these different electron carriers, like cytochromes and these proteins right here, protons move from the matrix into the intermembrane space. So you end up with a high concentration of protons here and low. So there's a huge concentration gradient. And remember, there's energy in any form of gradient. That energy can be used by this nifty little device right here, which we call ATP synthase or synthetase, can use that energy of flowing protons back down into the matrix to combine ADP and inorganic phosphate to make ATP. Okay, so that's the chemiosmotic theory. Osmotic because you have that big gradient of protons across that Christi membrane. All right, so let me look and see who can formulate a question. No? Okay, well, then over the weekend, got to look at it, and you got to ask me some questions on Tuesday. Okay? But I think we've gone over active transport and passive transport and diffusion, all that stuff in pretty good detail. I think maybe you can see what's happening there. All right. Also, make sure you know the difference between substrate-level phosphorylation and oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? Okay. All right, let's change the topic a little bit, talk about fat and protein metabolism. Fats and proteins can be used as energy sources, looking at some of the machinery inside the cell that we've talked about already. Fats can be hydrolyzed into glycerol and fatty acids. What kind of enzyme? I had a question, and I wasn't able to respond because the email wasn't working quite right for me. But I had a question, and I think it was relating to an online question or even a question that, for the quiz maybe this week. Okay, what kind of enzyme can be used to hydrolyze triglyceride into glycerol and fatty acid? What's the name of the general name of that enzyme? Okay, because a triglyceride is a lipid, and so the enzyme that will hydrolyze a lipid is called a lipase. Okay, all right, so a lipase will convert triglycerides into glycerol and fatty acids. Okay, that doesn't produce a lot of energy, but there is a lot of energy in fatty acids. And fatty acids can be broken down into carbon dioxide. One of the first processes that's necessary is beta oxidation. All right? So I don't want you to confuse beta oxidation, which is a metabolic pathway, with the activity of one enzyme that can break a triglyceride down. The enzyme that breaks a triglyceride down is lipase, but the system, the pathway that breaks fatty acids down for energy is beta oxidation. So there's a pretty significant difference between beta oxidation and just a run-of-the-mill kind of lipase. All right, so fatty acids can be broken down, and then those components can be run through the Krebs cycle, generating a lot of ATP by oxidative phosphorylation using those high-energy electrons donated to ETC by NADH and FADH2. Proteins can be broken down. into amino acids. That's just a protease. All right, and then amino acids can be deaminated, right? So take the amino group. What's an amino group? Anybody remember what an amino group is? And does an amino acid have an amino group? Absolutely, because that's how it got its name, right? And it's also got a carboxyl group, so it's an acid. So it's that NH2 group that's taken off of an amino acid, then it's no longer an amino acid, and the carbon backbone can then be broken down, and those two carbon fragments from amino acids can be donated to the Krebs cycle, so the Krebs cycle can turn, which then produces what? NADH and FH2. Those electrons then can be used by electron transport to generate all those ATP. All right, so these pathways sometimes can be used to interconvert some of these different compounds into each other. And this slide is not quite true, okay, in the sense that fats can never be converted into proteins, and fats can never be converted into carbohydrates. All right, so under some conditions, some of these things can take place. All right, carbohydrates can easily be converted into fats, and I want to have you see why that is. And proteins can be converted into fat, but once something is a fat inside your body, it's always going to be a fat, or that fat can be used to make ATP. So fats can only be used to make ATP or structural components of a cell. What do you need a fat for to make a structural component of a cell? Like the phospholipid bilayer, for sure. You need fats. So you definitely need fats in your body as well as hormones, right? Like steroid hormones and things like that. All right, let's take a look at this diagram right here. So here we have glycogen. Glycogen can be used to make glucose. What's the name of that pathway? Glycogenolysis, right, or glucose, depending on the energy needs of the cell. If the cell has a lot of ATP, glucose can be used, can be stored in the form of glycogen. What is the name of that solid arrow over here? That is glycogenesis, glycogenesis versus glycogenolysis, right? And don't forget, if you can't see how to spell those words, then you got to get a pair of glasses by the test, right, because it's easy to confuse them. All right, then these can be interconverted. So we see two arrows right here. That means that the free energy between these two different chemicals are very similar, so they can go in either direction depending on maybe various control signals or the level of ATP inside the cell. And there is one cell that can take glucose-6-phosphate and actually remove the phosphate group and convert it into glucose. What kind of organ can do that? What cell? The liver in particular, right? The liver is the only that has the phosphatase to do that. All right, so what is this pathway of glucose going all the way down to pyruvic acid? That's glycolysis. And depending on the ATP concentration and the NAD-NADH ratio, it can go in either direction, right? It can go up or down. So glycolysis is glucose to pyruvic acid, but if you start at pyruvic acid and go up to glucose, what's that called? That's gluconeogenesis, right? And that certainly can happen. All right, here's a step in glycolysis where, so fructose is a 6-carbon sugar. It gets broken down into 2 3-carbon fragments. One of the 3-carbon fragments is this little guy right here. You don't have to know the name, but it can be converted into glycerol. And how many carbons does glycerol have? It's got 3, right? So it can bind 3 fatty acids. So glycolysis can produce some intermediates that can make a fat, namely this glycerol molecule. Okay, and then we have fatty acids. Do you remember what a fatty acid looks like? Really long chain of hydrocarbons, right? And so we can combine these really long chains of hydrocarbons to glycerol and make a fat out of it. All right, and under conditions where your cells need ATP, this fat can be broken down to help make ATP. What's the name of the enzyme that's going to convert this fat, which is a triglyceride, into glycerol and fatty acids? Yeah, that's the lipase that does this step right here. All right, so lipase will make fatty acids, and then these fatty acids right here can be used to make acetyl-CoA. All right, so if we have pyruvic acid, which is 3 carbons, how many carbons are in this acetyl group? There are 2. So this step is a decarboxylation reaction, all right, which is the reason why it cannot run in the reverse direction. Animals just don't have the capability, maybe some do, but humans sure don't have the capability to take a 2-carbon molecule and make a three-carbon molecule out of it by adding a CO2. You almost need to be like a plant to do that kind of step, right? So once something is acetyl-CoA, right, when those two carbons are acetyl-CoA, they're kind of trapped, right? They can't go back up to make what? Glucose. Right, so anything that has two carbon fragments can't go back up to make glucose, but these two carbon fragments here can be joined together to make a fatty acid, and then those can be recombined with glycerol to make a fat. So these two carbon fragments have different fates depending on different conditions inside the cell. But if the cell needs to make energy, then it's not going to store acetyl groups as fat. It's going to take these acetyl groups and make ATP out of them. How would you do that? Through the Krebs cycle. Run them through the Krebs cycle in mitochondria so that the Krebs cycle can generate all those high energy electrons, which then are transferred to ETC by NADH and FADH2 to make a lot of ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. Okay. So once something is a two carbon fragment, it's kind of stuck. Can't be used to make glucose because of this decarboxylation step right here. Okay. The way you go from fatty acids to acetyl-CoA is a metabolic pathway that we call beta oxidation. So you might want to jot that down in the scheme of things that you see right here. So a lipase is used to convert fat into glycerol and fatty acids. Fatty acids can be converted into acetyl-CoA by a pathway called beta oxidation. And in the process of beta oxidation, it can produce some ATP. Just this step right here can produce some ATP, but by far the most that is made is when you take those two carbons and give them to the Krebs cycle. All right, so let's take a look at this diagram right here. You have acetyl-CoA, which has two carbons in it. This acetyl-CoA, depending on the energy balance inside the cell, for instance, if the cell is low on energy, what would you want to do with this acetyl-CoA? Run it through the Krebs cycle, right? And make a lot of ATP by oxidative phosphorylation, and that's going to turn these two carbons right here into two molecules of CO2. All right, if the energy demands of the cell are met, so there's high energy inside the cell, what might happen with this acetyl-CoA? It's going to be shuttled, it's going to be converted into fatty acids. These two carbon fragments, two at a time, will be added to a growing carbon chain, and it's going to create fatty acids, which then can be used to make triglycerides or phospholipids inside the cell. Okay, or this acetyl group can be used to make other kinds of lipid-like molecules by being converted into cholesterol, and cholesterol then can be converted into steroids or signaling compounds inside your body. What's an example of a steroid? Like estradiol, testosterone, yeah, sure, all of those different things, cortisone, things like that. Trying to think. Estradiol was on the news lately, and the announcer pronounced it in a really fascinating way. I forgot. Maybe if I can think about it a second, it was kind of interesting how they pronounced it estradiol. Estradiol. So if you hear estradiol, that's really the same thing as what? Estradiol. Okay. They put the emphasis on the wrong syllable there. Okay, so, all right, so acetyl-CoA can be used to make energy, can be used to make fatty acids, and then, you know, phospholipids, or it can be used to make steroid compounds, or if the cell is low on energy, these two carbon fragments can be joined together to make a four-carbon molecule, and through various rearrangements can make ketone bodies, all right, and these are really strange conditions right here, right, because if the cell needs energy, usually you would use the Krebs cycle to help you make a lot of energy. But the intermediates of the Krebs cycle are based on sugar molecules. They're sugar compounds. So if your body is low on sugar, or if a cell is low on sugar, this acetyl-CoA goes into ketone bodies, right? And then the cell can't make a lot of ATP by CO2. Under what conditions are your cells going to be low on sugar compounds? Like diabetes mellitus, for instance, right? So if somebody is suffering from diabetes mellitus, the Krebs cycle does not like to work because it doesn't have sugar intermediates. So what happens to these two carbon fragments? They get broken down, okay, into ketone bodies. So fatty acids, All right, somebody that's a diabetic, fatty acids can be converted into acetyl-CoA, producing some ATP to keep the cells alive, but most of it is trapped in this acetyl group, which then is converted into ketone bodies, and that changes the pH of their cells. It becomes very acidotic, okay? And then all that energy is lost. A ketone body is very volatile, which means that it likes to evaporate very easily. A good example would be acetone. And if you pour acetone on the tabletop, by the time if you turn around and look back at it, it has already evaporated. Okay, so somebody that's a diabetic that's not controlled, you might smell acetone or other kinds of ketone bodies on their breath because they're just excreting that compound. It just evaporates right out of their lungs. Okay, and where would you use acetone in your everyday life? At least some of you. Nail polish remover, right? The basic molecule is acetone. So you can get a whiff of what that smells like. All right, but there's another condition, okay, where somebody's cells are starving for sugar molecules. For instance, that when you're in a fasted state and when people go on some of these really wild fasts, all right, where they restrict their diet of all carbohydrates, what was the name of that diet? Atkins diet. All right, so when somebody's on an Atkins diet, they don't have any sugar molecules to run the Krebs cycle, so that means oxidative phosphorylation is shutting down. Right, they're eating a lot of fatty acids. Fatty acids by beta oxidation are converted into acetyl-CoA, producing a little bit of ATP for them. Right, and then their bodies convert that acetyl-CoA to ketone bodies that they then exhale right in their breathing. So that's a really ingenious way of controlling weight, right? Because what are you doing with these fatty acids? You are basically just breathing them out of your body instead of exercising all of that energy off, right? So that's fascinating. But what's the downside to an Atkins diet? Okay, you're not producing all of those ATPs that you normally produce from these fatty acids right here, and you're not producing any energy by glycolysis because you don't have any glucose in your diet. So guess what happens to people if they get really dingy as a result, okay, because their brain doesn't have ATP. People that are on an uncontrolled Atkins-type diet will drive on the wrong side of the road. They'll see a red stoplight, so what, because they're not maybe even seeing what's going on, okay, drive right through an intersection because their brain doesn't have ATP. And remember, how much ATP does your brain need? If you cut off blood supply to your brain, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? You got 2 to 3 seconds, right? So the citric acid cycle and oxidative phosphorylation is hugely important for brain tissue. So don't go on some kind of Atkins diet during this course, especially during any of the exams, because you just won't be able to figure out what's going on because oxidative phosphorylation is being shut down. So that's kind of a nice comparison between diabetes mellitus and that Atkins diet or any kind of diet that severely restricts you of carbohydrates. But if you work with a physician or a dietitian with an Atkins diet, okay, I think maybe some of you realize that it's not a total restriction of carbohydrates. It's maybe only the first week or week and a half, all right? And then you have to start eating carbohydrates once again, otherwise all the cells in your body just basically starve to death because these acetyl groups can't be used to make ATP via the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain. So that's pretty interesting stuff. Okay, lipogenesis is just what? The synthesis of lipids from what? Fatty acids and glycerol, and that's going to produce a triglyceride. That happens mostly in adipose connective tissue and liver tissues. And that's a really good energy storage form because there's 9 kilocalories of energy for every gram of lipid in a triglyceride. And carbohydrates have about half that, maybe not even half that, for the same amount of weight, right? That carbohydrates and proteins are 4 kilocalories per gram. And the other thing is, when you store proteins and carbohydrates in your body, it has to be packaged with water. So that even takes up more space. So when you store energy as a lipid, it's really wonderful because it has a lot of energy and it can be stored in an anhydrous form, meaning that it doesn't take up a lot of space. All right, so it's a really good form of energy. Okay. There's one, lipolysis, breakdown of fat into fatty acids and glycerol via hydrolysis by this enzyme right here. And then these fatty acids can be used to make acetyl-CoAs by beta oxidation. Maybe just draw that in on this slide right here for this step. Okay, and then a lot of ATP can be produced. All right, so I want to go over this pathway. This is beta oxidation, right? But I want to go back to this diagram right here, and I want to talk about one particular kind of food. All right, I think you made some of this in lab, right? You didn't have a license to make this compound, okay? But yeah, there we go. Somebody's thinking. I'm thinking of a fermentation process. What's a fermentation process? Okay, it's when it's an anaerobic process, right? That regenerates NAD+. Let me see if I can get this down right. So we have pyruvic acid. I'll draw it artistically right here. Pyruvic acid has how many carbons on it? It's got 3. Okay, and so here is pyruvic acid. And it can be converted into lactic acid. So let me draw it out. Pyruvate right here can be converted into, in our bodies, lactate. And lactate has 3 carbon atoms, right? But what else has to happen here? What else do you need? NADH. Okay, that's going to be converted into NAD, okay, and this is fine, and so this is a fermentation process, all right, so this just prevents the buildup of pyruvate inside your cells under anaerobic conditions, because if pyruvate builds up, that's going to block glycolysis by end product inhibition, all right. The other thing is, too, if pyruvate stays inside the cell, there's going to be a buildup of NADH that's going to stop glycolysis from happening as well. And what's the bad thing about stopping glycolysis? Then you don't have ATP production, right? Okay. So under anaerobic conditions, pyruvate is converted into lactate. That lactate can leave the cell, so there's no end product inhibition. And also then NADH or NAD plus is produced. What biochemical pathway relies on having NAD plus available? This has got to be there for glycolysis, right? If there's no NAD+, then glycolysis won't proceed and then no ATP is being made. All right, so this is a fermentation process in us. But there's another kind of fermentation process where you can take pyruvate, okay, and again, cells will take NADH, convert it into NAD+, but in this particular case, it's going to produce a CO2. Okay, and then this compound right here, and these little lines just represent hydrogen atoms. All right, so if we got a CO2 over here, how many carbons are we going to end up with? 2. All right, so here is, I'll draw the hydrogens in. What is this compound right here? That is ethyl alcohol, right? So that's adult beverage. So this reaction right here protects cells, keeps glycolysis working for some cells, but it produces what? Ethyl alcohol. And in us, what is ethyl alcohol? It's toxic, right? So it's toxic to our nervous system. So it's a good thing that we don't have this. This is alcohol dehydrogenase. We don't have that enzyme. That's a good thing, because otherwise, what would happen if we were to hold our breath? If we would deplete our bodies of oxygen, what would happen? Well, we'd become intoxicated if that were true, right? So our bodies don't make alcohol dehydrogenase. They make what? Lactate dehydrogenase, because lactate is not toxic. And as a matter of fact, your liver can take lactate and make what out of it again? Glucose by what? Gluconeogenesis pathway. Okay. So let's relate it to the slide that I have showing. We have a 2-carbon fragment that can be converted only into an acetyl group. And once something is a 2-carbon fragment or an acetyl group, what are the possible fates? Can you convert it into a carbohydrate? No. Can you convert it into a protein? There are 2 things that you can do with ethyl alcohol. right? Let's look at the slide. It can be run through the Krebs cycle if your cells are low on energy. It can be oxidized right into CO2 and water, making ATP, right, if you need energy, or what else? It can be used to make fatty acids. So when you drink alcohol, what is it like eating? It's like eating a bar of butter, okay? And your liver does that, and, you know, alcohol is actually fairly dangerous if you drink it consistently, even in small amounts every day. It's very toxic to the liver. The liver becomes very fatty when that happens, and that leads to all kinds of nasty things for the liver. Could be even liver cancer or cirrhosis or other kinds of things. Okay, so once something is a two-carbon fragment like ethyl alcohol, it's basically always trapped as fat inside your body. Okay. Let's look at beta oxidation. Got a couple minutes. So here we have a fatty acid, right? So it's a big long carbon chain with a carboxyl group on the end of it right here, hence fatty acid. And for beta oxidation to proceed, right, it takes an ATP. It's going to require one ATP. So it's going to combine with coenzyme A. So coenzyme A binds to this carboxyl carbon. And then there's going to be a rearrangement of chemical bonds. And in that rearrangement, some electrons will be lost by the fatty acid bound to coenzyme A. Those electrons are going to be picked up by FAD, right? And then FAD will be reduced into FADH2. And this process right here happens inside the mitochondria. And what can you do with FADH2? They're going to donate electrons to electron transport chain. And how many ATP under ideal conditions would be produced by this FADH2? Yeah, just put 2 right here. So cross off this 1.5. That's too complicated. 2. All right, then we get this compound. And by the addition of a water and some other rearrangements, we have an NAD plus converted into an NADH. Right? And so how many ATPs inside the mitochondria will NADH produce? Will produce 3. All right? And then finally, okay, this bond is going to be broken to produce an acetyl coenzyme A, right? A two-carbon fragment is an acetyl group. And then there is a little bit shorter fatty acid right here by 2 carbons. So if you started out with a 20-carbon fatty acid, by the time you get to this step over here, you're down to what? 18. And then that 18 will go through beta oxidation once again, chop off 2, and then chop off 2 once again. So for a 20-carbon fatty acid, it will run through beta oxidation, what, 9 times? Okay, because the final round, you'll end up with 2 acetyl CoAs. All right, and then what do you do with these acetyl CoAs? You run them into the Krebs cycle, producing a lot more ATP, right, for every turn of the Krebs cycle right here. All right, so it took 1 ATP to get it started, but it got 2 and 5, so it makes 4 ATP for reducing this fatty acid by 2 carbons every time it goes through this beta oxidation step right here. And since it's inside the mitochondria, and since it relies on the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain, this is an aerobic process. This can only happen under aerobic conditions, beta oxidation. All right, so I want you to make sure that you understand the difference between a lipase, what the function of lipase is, and beta oxidation. Which one produces more energy, beta oxidation or a lipase reaction? Beta oxidation, much more, okay, especially if you run it all the way through the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain. Okay. All right. Dang, I'm sorry. I must have talked really fast. So, does anybody have any questions? Like, I didn't quite hear you, but I'm thinking this one here?
No, lipolysis.
Okay. Before I go to the lipolysis one, is that what you're saying? Lipolysis? Before I go back to lipolysis, let's look at this one. Because I said the most important molecule is not even shown on this illustration. Okay? So here we have a diagram that shows like glycogenolysis and absorption of glucose and glucose transport, and we got glycolysis and Krebs cycle, aerobic versus anaerobic respiration. All right, so what's the most important thing on this slide? Is it the production of CO2? Is it the production of lactic acid? Or the production of pyruvic acid? Well, gee whiz, what the heck is the most important thing on this slide? ATP production, right? So make sure that on this diagram, you can write in how much ATP is being produced under ideal conditions inside the cell. All right, so you should know also that glycolysis happens in the cytosol. If you want to cross off cytoplasm, that's fine with me because cytoplasm really means, in a more modern term, means organelles plus cytosol. So we're just talking about enzymes that are freely dissolved in the cytosol. So that's cytosol. And then, don't forget, what do I call this little arrow right here? You might even want to draw that in on this slide. That's the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. Okay, and then you got the Krebs cycle. Krebs cycle makes three NADHs, one FADH, two, and also by substrate level phosphorylation, it makes something. What does it make by substrate level phosphorylation? An ATP for every turn, one ATP, because remember, it makes a GTP, which is converted into an ATP. Where is another ATP produced by substrate level phosphorylation? Glycolysis up here in the cytosol. Okay, and what makes most of the ATP inside of a cell? What process? Electron transport, and that's explained by what kind of theory? The chemiosmotic theory, that's right. And the chemiosmotic theory just says that high energy electrons that are brought into the electron transport chain by NADH and FADH2, okay, when those high energy electrons flow through the chain, it pumps protons into the intermitochondrial space, intermembrane space of the mitochondria. And as those protons flow back into the matrix, that ATP synthesis can then churn away and combine ADP with an inorganic phosphate and make an ATP out of it. So that ATP synthesis uses a proton gradient to make ATP, which is pretty fascinating. Okay. All right, so your question, going back to lipase. But if you want me to go over another slide, make sure before we go, because we got a couple minutes left. So tell me when to stop. Ah, here. This one? Or this one? Lipolysis. All right, so lipolysis is just the breaking down of a triglyceride into glycerol and fatty acids. Now here's a good question for you, maybe a little bit of a mind teaser right here. Glycerol, how many carbons are in glycerol? Three. Can glycerol, a breakdown product of a triglyceride, be used to make glucose once again? It can because it's not a two-carbon fragment, it's what? A three-carbon. So two glycerols can be joined together to make glucose. It's those two-carbon fragments that can't ever be used to make glucose once again because of that decarboxylation reaction right here from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA. But glycerol can enter right in the middle of glycolysis and those carbons can be shuttled back up to make glucose. But most of the carbons that are in fatty acids, I mean all the carbons in fatty acids, which are most of the carbons that are in fat, can't be used because of this decarboxylation reaction right here. Okay. So does that answer your question? Yeah? Okay. All right. Any other questions? Sign-in sheet is going around someplace. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Okay. Have a nice weekend.